Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. I'm co-host Ron Edwards. This is the Blog Radio program On Point. Co-host Don Allen is not able to be with us this afternoon, and unfortunately, we will not be able to take any telephone calls. We received very short notice, and unfortunately, technical equipment is not available that is functioning, if you will. We're certainly sorry about that. But later on in the program, we will identify a program in which you will certainly be able to get some of the feedback, if you will. Don will be back with us hopefully next week, next Saturday, and everything will possibly be up and working. But we have a number of items that we will discuss today here on Point, Black Blog Radio, if you will. Again, I'm your co-host, Ron Edwards. As we take a look at some events here in the city, and we take a look at a situation that raises some serious questions about commitment to the pursuit of justice, if you will, in law enforcement. And we'll also take a look at some aspects of the historical meeting of the Minnesota Advisory Committee to the United States Civil Rights Commission that took place on the campus of the University of St. Thomas. For those that are interested in a on-time critique, if you will, you're welcome to access our last Thursday's program on Black Focus 2 Blog Radio, our Thursday night program from 7 till 8:30, where we went into great depth, if you will, to review a very interesting meeting that had within the context of that meeting some very revealing, to say the least, testimony. In fact, some of the testimony surprised us, as we talked about on our program this past Thursday. We were surprised, really pleasantly, by some of the testimony. We were not surprised by the testimony of Judge Pam Alexander. That testimony would be consistent with what has been the long history of Judge Alexander. But we were pleasantly surprised by the testimony of Robbie Norman of Fuller, and specifically the testimony of Cam Gordon, Green Party, Second Ward, Minneapolis City Council, the only non-Democrat on the Minneapolis City Council here in the city of Minneapolis. And his testimony was both revealing, compelling, and riveting, if you will, in the session in the afternoon after the lunch break. We were committed to be there for every second of testimony, and we certainly reflect that on our Blog Radio program of this past Thursday from 7 to 8:30 on Blog Radio. That's him, by the way, prime time, if you will. And so we were committed that we be able to deal with that, if you will. Cam Gordon's testimony, and hopefully we're not having any technical problems again. Cam Gordon's testimony was very revealing. The purpose of this hearing, by the way, was to take a look at disparity, something we had been reporting on our television program, Black Focus, that airs on Sundays on Channel 17. In fact, on tomorrow, on our program, we so well anticipated different features of the testimony that was to take place within 2 days of the taping of the program that we're absolutely on point, if you will. And we reflected also in our newspaper column in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, Through My Eyes, that will come out on Wednesday. We knew that the real purpose of the hearing was to attempt to protect the Ryback administration, to sanitize two very critical analysis studies, if you will, of disparity, discrimination, racism, if you will, and a chronic problem with black unemployment and the unemployment of others of color, but specifically African Americans, because once again, the reports of April 2010 and October of 2010 clearly reflected that African Americans were at the bottom of the totem pole with respect to expectations and what was going on and what was not going on as it pertains to jobs, contracts, and et cetera. And so this five-hour, yes, it was. It was a five-hour public hearing, community forum, identified as a community forum, under the auspices of the very powerful United States Civil Rights Commission. It's Minnesota Advisory Committee, which every state in the United States has an advisory committee, as well as all of the territories, if you will. And so, consequently, okay. And again, we apologize for not having the phones available, as we said, because of the short notice we were given that we would not be joined by our co-host. We did not have an opportunity to make the technical changes that we needed to make. But back to the civil rights program, if you will, this past Thursday. It was an all-day program from 9 o'clock a.m. until adjournment at approximately 3 o'clock. There was only 15 minutes really set aside for real community input. And there were only actually two people that took the opportunity and took advantage of that, and I really couldn't blame them. We, as a former chairman of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission, as a man who has presided over public hearings and et cetera, it is disgraceful when the public, the people who are being affected, the victims, if you will, are only allowed at best a minute and a half to 2 minutes. This is something that happens with far too many governmental bodies. We see it all the time with the City Council of Minneapolis, St. Paul, that basically give citizens 2 minutes to talk about something that warrants, if you will, is up to an hour or 2 hours. But it reflects the disdain, if you will, the disrespect for citizens, if you will, for the taxpayers, if you will. When it was discovered, and it was actually only discovered on Tuesday, according to sources, that this commission meeting was being convened, if you will, with the chairman of the powerful United States Civil Rights Commission in Washington, Martin Castro, actually flying here to make an opening presentation, opening comments and remarks, if you will, that with respect to a limited distribution, if you will, and dissemination of information, many were not encouraged to be a part, if you will, of the process, and that was quite clear. In the morning session, we counted approximately no more than 51 people in the meeting. A couple of people came. A couple of people came, took pictures, and then left, as an example. The morning session was about 51. The afternoon session, after the lunch break, and let us just identify the panels for you, in that Randy First of the Minneapolis Star Tribune put something on his website. So for those of you that are interested, you should go to the Minneapolis Star Tribune's website. Randy First posted something late Thursday night after our hour-and-a-half blog radio broadcast, if you will, and our critiquing. Unfortunately, Mr. First had as many technical problems as we are having right now, and it didn't get posted until Friday morning, but his critique is rather interesting, but it is no way complete, nor does it reflect. In fact, let's just read on the air here at On Point, if you will, the news release. In fact, we actually had to send operatives to Chicago via the telephone, if you will. We received the agenda. We already knew and had already had discussions that clearly it was not intended for the public to actually participate other than those individuals specifically selected to help sanitize, specifically the disparity report of October of 2010. But the agenda was the following, and this is what is key right at the top for those of you that are interested in what the federal rules and procedures insist upon. This was a community forum, if you will. The topic was racial disparities in unemployment in the Twin Cities. The Minnesota Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and it was dated Thursday, September 15, 2011, University of St. Thomas School of Law. Started out from 9 to 9:10. Introductions by a woman identified as Ms. Pounds, Lee B. Pounds. She is the chair, interestingly enough, of the Minnesota Advisory Committee and a professor at University of St. Thomas School of Law. In fact, the hearing was held in the what is called moot court room in the college campus there at the university. There was then a welcoming about 5 minutes from Martin R. Castro, chair, United States Commission on Civil Rights. That was basically kind of bland, if you will. The first panel was an overview of unemployment disparities and causes in Minnesota. From 9:15 to 10:30. We're going to suggest, by the way, at the conclusion of reviewing this agenda, how you may want to call and put a call in. Our colleague, Mr. Allen, as an example, will be on KFAI tomorrow morning from 10 to 11:30, I believe, with Lenny Chisholm and Lenny Chisholm's, Mr. Chisholm's co-host. And certainly, I know Mr. Allen would welcome any calls from you in the public who would want to discuss with him his observations. Don posted on YouTube some pictures of the hall itself, beautiful, beautiful facility, as well as the panel, if you will. And so that first panel came into play, if you will, and gave its reflections. Those reflections were posted by us on Thursday evening on the blog radio program known as Black Focus 2. That airs from 7 to 8:30 on blog radio. And so you're welcome to access on demand our critique of what happened that day, if you will, from 9 o'clock in the morning until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The second panel was government contracts and barriers to small businesses, if you will. Two of the four slated invitees did not come, but in that particular panel discussion, as we indicated earlier, there was a very dynamic presentation, as there was in the morning session, and we identified for the morning session the first panel, the beloved and respected Judge Pam Alexander. There was then a lunch break, and so everything was flowing at that particular point in time, if you will. People were getting information, the 51 attendees at that session in the mock courtroom there at the University of St. Thomas. Coming back was panel three. It was entitled Barriers to Employment / Government Response. Quite a bit of use of that word, barriers, if you will. It was in that particular panel that I, professionally, as a former chairman of the Minneapolis Commission, if you will, as a former hearing examiner and et cetera, in cases, I thought that the most dramatic, dynamic, if you will, and yet indicting and incriminating testimony came from Cam Gordon, City Council Member Ward 2, who is a Green Party, only non-Democrat on the Minneapolis City Council. And his comments and what we encourage people to do on our program this past Thursday night on Black Blog Radio, if you will, Black Focus 2, is to request a transcript for those of you that are interested in this testimony and how this sanitation basically took place, if not for Judge Alexander, if not for Mr. Norman, if not for Cam Gordon, and if not for Reverend Gill. This would have been a whitewash, if you will, a clean sweep, if you will. But Cam Gordon pointed out something that's very interesting. By the way, let us give you also the address of where you should be able to find a copy of the transcript, if you will, directly from the regional office of the United States Commission on Civil Rights. They are located at the following telephone number. We'll give you the number. There's a woman there by the name of Miss Allen. She is the liaison for the state of Minnesota as it pertains to this district, if you will. The number that you could contact her at is 312-353-8311. Let us repeat that number again. Her name is Miss Allen, 312-353-8311. She is the keeper of the records, if you will. We would assume that the transcript should be ready in about a month, and the city of Minneapolis certainly will be getting its first copies. The Minnesota Advisory Committee will have access. And also, we would encourage you to contact Professor Pounds at the University of St. Thomas. She is the chair of the Minnesota Advisory Committee to the United States Commission on Civil Rights. Excuse us. And we assume that she should be able to facilitate, if you will, copies of the transcript. Now, back to Cam Gordon and his reflections. One of the things that Mr. Gordon said that even took a veteran such as myself totally off my feet was that when he came onto the council in 2005, that his colleagues, these were his words, that his colleagues on the council really had no concern or interest in the disparity that was taking place within Minneapolis city government, the contracts, if you will, the fact that African Americans were not receiving contracts, were not receiving jobs within the city, were not receiving jobs on public projects under the auspices and control of the city. He even reflected on the hiring policies of different city departments, things that we certainly have spoken to as an advocate, as a historian, if you will, as a journalist in our many writings and et cetera. In fact, we have, in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, we have written, and it is reflected in our column that will be coming out this coming Wednesday, we have written over 60 articles that talk in terms of disparity and et cetera. We have published an additional 30 papers, and we have 13 solution papers. So we do not apologize, nor do we take a back seat, and certainly we feel that we have boots on the ground, if you know what I mean. The fourth and final panel was probably the most interesting and most disingenuous in many respects, and this was the so-called community response panel. And this panel consisted of a Caucasian woman who has been involved with light rail in St. Paul. She is in fact the executive director of the District Council of Collaboration of St. Paul and Minneapolis. But it was the testimony of Lewis King of OIC, who also carried the credentials as a member of Minnesota Hire, which he takes credit for creating, and Scott Gray of the very beleaguered and under siege Minneapolis Urban League, which, you know, has cut back to a 4-day week and a 10% pay cut for its employees. They were the community's responders, if you will. And I'm just not sure that they got the job done. I'm not sure that they even got their points across, if you will. As we said before, if not for the presence of Reverend Gill, a minister at church in St. Paul representing Isaiah, and I know some of you out there know about Isaiah. Reverend Gill did not hesitate to talk in terms of racism. Again, with the exception of Reverend Gill, going backwards, if you will, Reverend Gill, Cam Gordon, if you will, Ravi Norman of Thor, and the beloved and respected Judge Pam Alexander. All the other panelists, if you will, stayed away from the issue of racism and race. Oh, let me go correct myself, because there was another hero. We won't name him. We'll let some of those that also say they were there identify this individual, because this individual indicated that as the keeper of the record, if you will, and this individual is white, so we assume you'll figure it out at some point if you get a copy of the agenda and the panels. This individual confirmed what Cam Gordon was to speak to about 2 hours later, and that was the city had known for quite some time, long before the disparity report, which the taxpayers of this city paid $500,000 for, and it took 5 years to complete. This individual indicated that the numbers were beyond discouraging, that the numbers were actually outrageous. They were extremely troubling, if you will, that it represented clearly a red flag. Now, here's one of the reasons that we kind of go back to that. Normally, when you have something as high-powered as this panel, again, we repeat, racial disparities in unemployment in the Twin Cities, and certainly crafted around three or four or five studies, if you will, but specifically two very hard-hitting studies and examinations which came out in 2010, you would think that the panel that is hearing the testimony would then begin to ask a series of real tough questions, probing, if you will, even though the panels were restricted in their time frame, but understanding that Professor Pounds is the quote-unquote facilitator, if you will, kind of like the chief judge, if you will, of the supreme body that's taking the testimony. One of the things that was quite obvious to me as a longtime observer at court, if you will, as one who has sat on panels, one who has been involved in the examination of a testimony, evidence, and et cetera, is that you respond by asking the toughest possible questions so that the necessary flavor, but more importantly, the respect of what people are putting on the line, because in the case of a couple of individuals, they were putting business relationships and et cetera on the line as they talked in terms of racism, as they talked about who was responsible. But there were no tough questions. There was no tough examination from the panel. And one of the things, and one of the reasons, and I have to say that yours truly was shocked. I was shocked when I entered the hall at approximately 9:04 a.m. On Thursday morning that I observed that two of the members of the Minnesota Advisory Committee to the United States Civil Rights Commission was Velma Corvell, the director of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department, and Craig Taylor, who purports himself to be the diversity officer for the University of Minnesota. Now, the first thing that I thought about as I viewed both of them is that I have basically known them as obstructionists, if you will, as roadblocks, if you will, as the very barriers and barricades that were highlighted in, quote-unquote, announcing and identifying the panels that people were serving on, particularly their panel, if you will, a panel that, quote-unquote, was to talk in terms of government involvement and et cetera. In fact, panel two, when Mr. Norman was talking, became somewhat embarrassing for the Civil Rights Advisory Panel, because Mr. Norman, as did three other speakers, talk in terms of the barriers, the obstruction, the barricades, if you will, that had been presented by government officials. And lo and behold, they actually were talking about the city of Minneapolis and the University of Minnesota. And I'm sitting there, you know, in the audience, you know. And, of course, there had already been some anticipation that I would be one of the kind of people that would show up and raise hell and jump up and down and scream and holler. That's not my style. That's for other people, if you know what I'm saying. But it was amazing to watch the silent response as at least four of the presenters talked in terms of the obstruction, if you will. And so then I began to, you know how you said quietly, if you will, and I began to look at both of these two African Americans in very, very powerful, powerful positions. And I realized that Velma Corvell, as an example, had stayed as far away as she possibly could from talking about the disparity reports, the shredding of documents in her department, the fact that the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department has lied under previous directors and under her stewardship, that they do site visits, that they compile numbers, and et cetera. And then I began to just take a look at the whole host of individuals that are not on the wall of heroes, if you will, that we've already identified. And when Louis King came in and was talking about the things that, you know, he was doing, my mind reflected back to the things that they didn't do on Target Field, which, just like the TCF Stadium, owned by the University of Minnesota, how those two edifices, if you will, were built without African-American participation, and cookbooks, if you will, and falsified and forged numbers. And so as I sat there through this long morning and afternoon, if you will, and then at basically 5 minutes to three, because they did run a tad over, Chair Pounds announced that there would be this basic 15 minutes set aside. What happened? The room actually immediately emptied, if you will. In fact, when the two young ladies who had signed up to speak, both of them talking not so much about the specific information or testimony that had been given, but the kind of their own observations about how people needed to work together, I counted the room, and we had gone from, you know, 27 people that were in the room down to five, if you will. I then saw the liaison person from Chicago. She had already boxed up everything and et cetera. The two young ladies, both African-Americans, did about a six-minute spin, if you will, and talked about what was happening. And at that point, Professor Chair Pounds adjourned the meeting, and people did a lot of backslapping and et cetera, and went on about their business. Now, I had expected, really, the next morning to have seen maybe a somewhat of a in-depth reflection by Randy Furst in the Star Tribune. And when I didn't see it, because I know that Louis King said in a meeting just earlier in the week that they had made and put Randy Furst's mind in the right direction, that in the story that they had written about tornado relief and et cetera, that some of the members of the so-called core group of the tornado relief group had made Randy Furst understand, you know, the lay of the land and gotten his mind right. And so I had expected him to give an in-depth examination, if you will, and applaud the sanitizing of the reports and basically indicate that there was no problem in the city of Minneapolis with respect to diversity or disparity, the lack of diversity and guaranteed disparity in employment / unemployment. But he didn't do that, and one of the things that came across and came back from the Star Tribune is that they didn't hear anything new, if you will, that they themselves in March of this year had written a piece following up really on the some 60 articles that we have written, if you will, over the last 6 or 7 years. And so there was basically nothing new, didn't hear anything dynamic, though I don't agree, because I think that when you get a sitting city council member, white, if you will, in the case of Cam Gordon, who has the courage, really, as we move up on the 4:30 hour, who has the courage, if you will, to talk in terms of the mindset of his colleagues with respect to the issue of race and inclusion, if you will, or the lack of inclusion, if you will, I think that that was newsworthy and should have been reflected to the public. But more importantly, probably, is that certainly if the advisory committee, particularly with Ms. Corvell and Mr. Taylor and Professor Pounds being the three African-American or Negro members on the committee, that they certainly should have made sure that the kind of aggressive comments would be made. But as we said earlier in these reflections, that it is tough for tough questions to be presented and advanced when the folks sitting on the other side, in other words, on the Minnesota Advisory Committee, are actually aiding and abetting what has happened to the African-American community, what has befallen the African-American community. And certainly they do not have, you know what I'm saying, the passion, the commitment, if you will, the tenaciousness, the drive to ask the kind of questions that make us get a better understanding. Because the one thing that was a common thread in this five-hour hearing, as I said before, my friends, I mean, 5 hours of you know, public time was taken up here, if you will, though the public was really not allowed to really participate other than for that little 10-minute segment at the end. That certainly a series of recommendations of solutions and et cetera. Now, Mr. Norman was specifically asked, as well as Judge Alexander, about solutions. They had some recommendations and et cetera. We go more into detail in that on our program this past Thursday on Blog Radio, if you will, Black Focus 2. And again, we invite you to access that program on demand and reflect upon our examination within hours, because you see, we're just basically 3.5 hours removed from the hearing, if you will. Everything was fresh in our minds, if you will, with respect to what we had heard, what we had seen, the number of attendees, and et cetera. And so we were saddened in conclusion on this particular matter. The public hearing, if you will, public forum, the taking of testimony, if you will, we were saddened. But one thing I do have to admit that there was no, and that was rather interesting because the stenographer is, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, qualified and certified to administrate the oath, to give testimony under oath. I do have to ask this question of Professor Pounds, if you will, Chair of the Minnesota Advisory Committee to the United States Commission on Civil Rights, why folks were not asked to give testimony under oath. And the reason that I said that is that there were some very interesting inconsistencies on panel 4. And in fact, at one point I was joined by a member of the Minnesota legislature, a white member of the Minnesota legislature, and we really had a rather kind of interesting whispering exchange as we listened to the testimony of Mr. Gray and Mr. King, testimony that really should have been examined in light of it being given to a body of such significant power, reporting to a body of even greater power, if you will. But then, as we will say in our column in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, that column has already been written, and in fact, that column was actually written on Tuesday, 2 days before the hearing, that we knew that the tough questions would not be asked, though we did not know on last Tuesday that Velma Corvell and Taylor were members of the United States Civil Rights Commission Advisory Committee, the advisory committee. And that also explained a situation earlier in the week when the so-called Oversight Committee for the construction of the Minneapolis Public Schools District Headquarters on the 1200 block on Broadway in North Minneapolis met for only 26 minutes, had no documented figures, even though they had posted some numbers on a big board, a billboard out in front of the building. Those numbers have not been authenticated, certified, if you will, but then we as black folk understand that that is not a prerequisite, if you will, for honesty and integrity and transparency. And so in closing, it was unfortunate that this historical event, because the advisory committee really hadn't had a real public hearing since 1999. If they do, they had it like they had this one this past Thursday at the University of St. Thomas. They have it in secret. Maybe they will say they had it in camera, if you will. That's, you know, that's when you go into judges' chambers and you speak in whispered tones, if you will, and the jury and the spectators cannot hear what you're talking about. Maybe that's what it was. Maybe it wasn't important as an example for the citizens of this city to hear a sitting city council member, Cam Gordon, indicate that there was no commitment really to deal with the issue of disparity, that that is basically a issue, racial discrimination, the continued undercutting of the African-American economic base was all a part of what is really a policy, a doctrine, if you will. And in fact, hopefully my associate and co-host, Mr. Allen, who, as we said earlier, will be on KFAI from 10 to 11:30 tomorrow morning. Phone lines, I understand, according to the blogs, will be open. And certainly it will be an opportunity for some of you to ask for reflections on Cam Gordon's testimony, on Judge Pamela Alexander's testimony, on Robbie Norman's testimony, and on the testimony of another quote-unquote city employer. Well, let me be upfront with this. The gentleman that I thought fully supported what Cam Gordon was to say in the afternoon session is the workforce manager, City of Minneapolis Employment and Training Program. He, by the way, is a PhD, and as I said before, I'm a very critical individual, but I was extremely impressed with his testimony on the record. But it was interesting when asked what was the source, if you will, of these problems, this denial, this pattern and practice. That's the key word. Law professors and lawyers like to use those words, pattern and practice, but yet they never asked that question. It was interesting that the legal question of pattern and practice was not asked of anybody, including Judge Pam Alexander. That is an important legal equation, if you will, that talks in terms that it is systemic and beyond, if you will, and could represent a significant conspiracy and conspiratory activity, if you will. But because this panel, the Minnesota Advisory Committee to the United States Civil Rights Commission, was not committed to fully pursue. Heck, they weren't even committed to fully disclose, if you will. You know what I'm saying? In fact, I thought that at some point both Ms. Corvell and Mr. Taylor should have disqualified themselves, if you will. And, in fact, they should have had concerns when the agenda was set by the United States Civil Rights Commission in Washington, its regional office in Chicago, and the Minnesota Advisory Committee here in Minnesota. People of significant principle, if you will, and integrity would have probably disqualified themselves. When you specifically talk in terms of the two panels that dealt with government contracts and barriers to small businesses and barriers to employment / government response, I would have thought that the City of Minneapolis, the Civil Rights Director, and the University of Minnesota's disparity, quote-unquote, expert would have disqualified themselves, would have removed themselves from the panel. It will be interesting to see what latitude, as an example, they will be allowed, they being Ms. Corvell and Mr. Taylor, and Professor Pounds, who is chair of the powerful Minnesota Advisory Committee, who made such a stirring presentation back on the 30th of March in the presence of Governor Mark Dayton, if you will, who talked with great passion at that time about the conditions that confronted African-Americans economically and et cetera. That great conference in which everyone was patting themselves on the back for quote-unquote having happened, if you will, that brought forward this information and et cetera. And yet, at no point did the professor on March 30th, 2011, point out that she presided over a very powerful and significant committee, the Minnesota Advisory Committee to the very powerful United States Civil Rights Commission. You know, back on March 30th, that would have been important. That would have been crucial to giving greater clarity, if you will, and helping the strategy of those that said they were going to follow up with the governor. And yet, on the 15th of September, 2011, at the University of St. Thomas, I did not hear that same passion coming from the chair of the powerful Minnesota Advisory Committee to the powerful, powerful United States Civil Rights Commission. I didn't hear that kind of passion. I didn't hear that kind of examination. And, of course, you're not to take our word here on point, or certainly my word. My co-host is not here with me today. But certainly the transcript. As we pointed out, and let us do that before we go into the last basically 20 minutes. We will conclude this broadcast, if you will, today at 5 o'clock. But again, the woman who is the liaison to the state of Minnesota is a woman by the name of Allen, if you will, and she is at the telephone number 312-353-8311. She is the keeper of the records. I would suggest for those of you that want to contest, if you will, critique what Mr. Edwards has said here on this program today and what we said actually on Thursday within hours after the conclusion of this gathering, this so-called public forum, if you will, to examine for yourself and to examine me, if you will, that we have been inconsistent with our reflections over the last hour and some minutes with respect to what happened and how it happened. We, in fact, welcome that. Now, on our Sunday program, our Black Focus 2 program, a half-hour program on Sunday, we will reflect a little bit more on some even more egregious information that has to do with why Ms. Corvell and Mr. Taylor should have disqualified themselves, and why both the city of Minneapolis and the University of Minnesota should not be concerned for legal reasons with respect to these individuals representing the franchise and the interest of the city of Minneapolis and a land-grant college, the University of Minnesota, in light of what happened on the TCF Stadium and two major hospital projects on the campus of the University of Minnesota and what happened in Minneapolis with respect to Target Field and, quote-unquote, other projects, the Loring Bridge and et cetera. We will discuss that a little bit on our program tomorrow, on Sunday, if you will. Now, within that particular context, we must indicate the following, if you will. We want to apologize. We had some technical difficulties. We hope we haven't lost a lot of our audience. But what we want to do over the remaining 15 minutes of this program of On Point, we want to take a look at a story in this morning's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. It had to do with a story that we first broke on Black Focus, our other program, back on the 25th of July, when gunmen fired upon a Minneapolis police car and et cetera. In this morning's edition of the Star Tribune on the Metro section at page B5 is a story about a young man who has been apprehended and says that he was the gunman who fired on the police car back on the 25th of July and indicated that he was bored. This young man's name is Milo Gomez, 18, of Minneapolis. We had been concerned for quite some time because in a short time after that attack, that ambush of that Minneapolis patrol car, and there's also been a second event involving police being fired on in the vicinity of 27th and Morgan, we were concerned because within that four-day period, a young Mr. Braxton, 14 years of age, and Mr. Gomez, the cousin of the man identified in today's edition of Star Tribune, had been shot and killed under very questionable circumstances. By the way, there appears to be no suspects, if you will. No one seems to be in custody. And when we were made aware early yesterday morning that Milo Gomez, 18 years old, cousin of Rodel Gomez, 13 years old, had allegedly confessed, we began to have a better understanding of a very puzzling set of circumstances, which certainly has not served the interests of justice, if you will, and that is we wondered why the Gomez family was being so disrespected, if you will, during the course of reflections in the days immediately following his death and just 4 days prior to that, the death of young Mr. Braxton. And we knew there were some factors, which we will not discuss on this program, that would probably make the police not feel as much of an affinity towards the Gomez family as opposed to the Braxton family, but that doesn't have anything to do with negating, if you will, the pursuit of justice. And so we had the suspicion. We wondered, as an example, why all of the events surrounding the deaths of the two young children, yes, were concentrated primarily around Mr. Braxton. We were getting intel that the Gomez family was not being talked to. In fact, we understand there was an intervention, if you will. The homicide unit was encouraged to at least talk to the family, sit down with them. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. But we also became even more concerned. An additional red flag went up when there was a activity at the corner of 17th and Morgan where young Mr. Braxton had been gunned down. And also, later on, we were aware that there was a heavy police presence at the Gomez funeral at St. Olaf's Church in North Minneapolis, but no such presence, no such indication of concern about retaliation or et cetera at Shiloh, where Mr. Braxton was interned, if you will. Well, now it all comes together as we basically go into the last 11 minutes of this edition, if you will, of On Point. When it became clear over the last 36 hours, let us say, that at some point in time, number one, on the occasion of the death of young Mr. Gomez, the 13-year-old, if you will, that some police felt and thought that he was either the gunman of the events of 25 July or a little bit later on, they felt that he, because he was a member, you know, by birth of the family that was involved and it was now suspect in the attack on Minneapolis police on the 25th of February, that made the whole family contaminated. In fact, there's a certain word that is used in which you talk in terms that a person is a piece of manure, if you know what I mean, except a different word starting with S is used. We were hearing some of that as a activist, if you will, as a former co-chair of the Department of Justice's Police Community Relations Council. We didn't quite understand why, if you will. But then, with the break yesterday morning, the arrest of Milo Gomez, if you will, and his so-called statement that he did it because he was bored, it all fell into place that at some point in time, in the hours immediately following young Mr. Gomez's body being discovered about a half a block from where he was initially shot, having bled to death because he was hiding in fear and et cetera, that it is now quite clear that there were some within law enforcement who felt that this young man did not deserve an investigation, that his family did not deserve justice. And it probably explains one of the reasons that just 4 days ago his father, a hardworking African-American employed at a Pacific business, a government facility, in fact, for over 19 years, was talked to in such a shoddy manner to the extent that authorities were basically saying they weren't interested in his, the father's, information and talk in terms of how his family was coordinated, if you will, and I say coordinated, what the expectations were within that family, particularly his 13-year-old son who was to die on the streets of Minneapolis. And the father was told that that information, where he worked and how he disciplined his children and how much caring he had, was no interest to the Minneapolis Police Department and its investigators and et cetera. And that father talked about how hurt he was and et cetera. And then I began, over the last 24 hours prior to this program this evening, I began to realize that there, after the so-called celebrations and after the so-called, you know, leaders and folks with boots on the ground and et cetera showed up and did their thing, and the mayor and the chief and them, that this thing has been put on the back burner. And I'd been hearing for the last 20 days or so these complaints about the fact that the African-American community is not cooperating, et cetera. Well, of course, that's not true, if you will. And as one talks to the father of young Mr. Gomez, the 13-year-old now deceased, and as one hears the heart-wrenching reflections of how that family has been treated, and then one saw kind of a different situation for the Braxton family, but then one realizes that there are no suspects in custody in either one of these specific cases, if you will. And as was stated to me earlier this morning in a private and privileged conversation, if you will, that there are a lot of people in the African-American community who are pretty much fed up with what they consider to be a cavalier dismissal of the importance of life of African-Americans, if you will, particularly our young and our children. Last night, along the 3200 block of Blaisdell Avenue North, another young African-American gunned down, found face down, dead in the street, if you will. Another African-American on 36th and Columbus, shot and wounded in the leg, if you will. Two deaths by stabbings, if you will, three or four deaths by gunfire. One cannot even keep up with the number of homicides and assaults and et cetera. Yet we are all continuously told over the past summer that crime is down, assaults are down, aggravated assaults are down, murders are not quite down because we don't even get the numbers anymore, do we? But that's what we're being told, and we have to tell you as a person of community who's been here for a long time, I heard something on a radio program on KMOJ on Thursday afternoon at 6. I heard on Lisa Jones's program, a father, an African-American activist, who had his daughter on, and he and the host were talking about this child's experience and knowledge of houses of that facilitate drugs and sex slave and abuse of children and et cetera. And as I heard that program in conclusion of tonight's program here on Point, I said that I certainly hoped that the community activists and Ms. Jones and others would, in the tradition of the village, you know what I'm saying, that they would approach Chief Tim Dolan, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman, and U.S. Attorney Todd Jones, because some of what this activist and Ms. Jones and the activist's 14-year-old daughter talked about was certainly a significant criminal enterprise that dealt with drugs, dealt with the abuse of young women, if you will, dealt with houses that have been foreclosed that are now set up as trap houses or some kind of name like that, where our young children, if you will, are being lured into acts of criminal activity and criminal sexual misconduct and et cetera. And so I would hope that certainly we will be hearing an announcement pretty quick, because I know that the two adults on the program are talking in terms of being in our schools, if you will, talking about the importance of values, if you will. And so I just hope that, quote-unquote, these community leaders will reach out to the right authorities, and we will begin to see some sweeps where the authorities close down these illegal operations, if you will, and protect our children. I mean, I'm hearing a lot of discussion about the children, about the babies, and et cetera. And so in that context, when I think about two young babies gunned down in the street, if you will, Mr. Braxton and Mr. Gomez in that order, and I see preferential consideration, preferential activities going on because some police authorities felt that one life was less valuable than the other. And as black people, we have a pretty good understanding of just how unimportant we are and how we are held or how we are not held as it pertains to our rights and our franchise, if you will. And so this program took a look and takes a look at disparity. Disparity comes in many different forms, my friends. Not only is it with jobs and housing, but it has to do with life, the importance of life, the importance of salvaging, if you will, saving and sitting on and in the right direction, our youth, our future, if you will. And if these things are not happening or not about to happen or there is no intention to see that it happens, then what takes place is that we find ourselves as a community under siege, and we start attending far too many funerals. We start visiting far too many hospitals, far too many penal institutions, be they county jails or state or federal penitentiaries and et cetera. And then we all sit around and we wring our hands and we raise the questions to each other about why, what's happened, how did it happen, why did it happen? And in many respects, there comes a point in time when we have an obligation and responsibility to begin to answer that question, if you will. And as long as there are certain levels of conduct that are commensurate with quote-unquote values, if you will, then we'll always be asking the questions, going to funerals, and living in fear. And I got to tell you, my friends, that that's not the way that a society, and specifically a race within a society, should be expected to exist. We have enough pressure now on us as the sons and daughters of the African with respect to what is happening in the marketplace, what is happening on the economic front, if you will. And so at some point, we're going to have to stop, as the brothers used to say on the streets, we're going to have to stop shucking and jiving, okay? And we're going to have to move an agenda in which we talk realistically about what's happening and how it's happening. Again, I'm co-host Ron Edwards, coming to you with a one-hour version of On Point, if you will. Hopefully, Don Allen will be back with us next week. As we said before, though, our program, Black Focus 2, on Thursdays from 7 to 8:30, we will have the phone lines open, and we will be talking about many of the issues in which we are talking about here. And there's never enough time or space that we don't have a right to talk about it. So thank you again. I hope we haven't had too many technical difficulties. I'm Ron Edwards. This is On Point. Good evening.